This is Glow in the Dark Radio. The science fiction podcast with original independent science fiction written and performed by Mike Luoma, with music by Kevin MacLeod, The Vatican Assassin Trilogy, and The Adventures of Alibi Jones by Mike Luoma are available in ebook, trade paperback, and audiobook wherever you find your books online. Get links and details at glowinthedarkradio.com. This is the science fiction podcast, Glow in the Dark Radio. I'm your host, your writer and reader, Mike Luoma. We have a part of the Archmage's History of the Future on this episode of Glow in the Dark Radio, covering the earliest of times in alien history, up through the 2040s, up to 2050, on this episode. This is the background of both The Vatican Assassin and The Adventures of Alibi Jones. It's my future history that I wrote back in the 90s originally to set up Vatican Assassin when I began writing that in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. So I've had to update it. I had to update it to put this together. And that's when I decided it was going to be the Archmage under the mountain from the Starseeds of Earth who was going to be telling this story. So it starts out in his voice, but then I decided it seemed like it should shift into my narrating voice because, I don't know, the Archmage gets a little annoying after a while, but I didn't do the whole thing in character. So it gets a little drier as, you know, the information gets more history-like. So I don't do the whole thing in character, just the opening section. But again, this is the background for both The Adventures of Alibi Jones and Vatican Assassin. And we're just doing this for this week. Remember, next week, we're going to begin the special 15th anniversary edition audiobook of Vatican Assassin with all kinds of cool cameos. I've got some very cool friends helping me out on the new audiobook. Paul E. Cooley, Veronica Jaguar, Keith Hughes, Starla Hutchton, John Miro, Dave Robison, and Scott Sigler, all contributing their efforts in different ways as different characters. Cameos. Most of it's me, most of it's my narrating. I do most of the major characters. But yeah, some awesome cameos from some amazing talents. I'm honored they'd decided they'd do this with me. Very cool. So we're going to start listening to that next week, the Vatican Assassin 15th Anniversary Edition, very special audiobook on this podcast. Now, speaking of Vatican Assassin and Alibi Jones, as promised, I'm going to do a Q&A after we listen to the future history. A couple of Q&A questions answered. I actually ended up getting a few, so we'll be doing those after the Archmage's History of the Future segment. A little bit of book news first. Of course, the big book news is that the 15th anniversary edition of Vatican Assassin is coming out. The ebook for sure will be out next Friday, November 20th. The audiobook has been uploaded. It has been approved as far as like quality control and distribution goes for my non-audible Amazon distribution, which is through this company called Findaway Voices. So like Google Play, a couple of the library ones, a few others are going to be getting it sooner than Audible, I think. Audible takes like 30 days, so they've just gotten the audiobook this week. I'm not sure what their turnaround time is going to be on that. Sometimes when you're an author and narrator who's worked with them, they'll they'll try to help, you know, they'll try to accommodate as best they can. So we'll see when those come out. And the paperback also went to printers this past week as well, so that may be a little delayed too. We'll have to wait and see. But for sure, the ebook will be out on the 20th, and everything else is coming. Of course, the book we were listening to, The Star Seeds of Earth, is out, available in paperback, ebook, audiobook. Makes a lovely holiday gift, whatever holiday you're celebrating. Christmas, solstice, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Festivus. Actually, I don't know that we need to celebrate Festivus. I'm kind of tired of hearing grievances, I'll tell you. Please consider becoming a patron if you want to help support this podcast and my fiction efforts. Patreon.com/glowinthedarkradio. Patrons are getting Chapter 4 of Vatican Assassin this week. They've been getting it well ahead of everybody else. So they're hearing Keith Hughes as Cardinal Anderson. Many thanks to Keith. He's one of my cameos. And actually, Keith, I think, has probably the meatiest cameo as the Cardinal, because he keeps coming back. Chapter 5 is an awesome chapter. The patrons will be getting that one next week. That has Keith, of course, still. It has Starla Hutchton as Nita Bendix, and Scott Sigler as Daniel McIntyre. So, that's Chapter 5. I'm looking forward to people hearing that one. It just came out so well. I mean, I know some talented people, and it's great that they've been kind enough to honor me with their gifts for this very special audiobook. All right, that's going to do it for the book news. Let's check out The Archmage's History of the Future, from the beginning through the 2040s up to 2050, on this episode of Glow in the Dark Radio. Coming up next.
Hi, I'm JC. My co-host Cindy and I host the Fix It Home Improvement Podcast. We cover projects that every homeowner should know and top-rated products for home and garden. You can check it out on your favorite podcast app. It's called Fix It, F-I-X-I-T, Home Improvement.
This is the Archmage's History of the Future on Glow in the Dark Radio. Archmage's History of the Future by Mike Luoma. In the beginning, I, the Archmage, can tell of the long time, having seen the cycles, having lived as both a human and one of the people. For in the time before your time now, the people ruled the settled planets of the universe with a firm yet fair grip. Yet all who rule seem destined to corruption and collapse when in power too long. Whether it was power itself or the entrenchment of power which corrupts, I cannot say. Still, it does corrupt in time. The best of the people fretted, while the worst ascended. The people became known for cruelty. Our rule became an iron fist, crushing the freedoms of so many races under our dominion. Power which was given can be taken away as well. When those we ruled grew weary of our reign, they conspired to throw off our yoke. And the few best of us left helped them. We turned the race we had created eons ago to take care of our needs, the servants, against us. Altered their bioenergetics so they could betray their masters and become the Eldred. When we were enlisted in the longevity plans of Azimet and the elite of the people, for they needed expertise only some of the best could offer, a and we conspired to alter those plans. Our energies would join with those of the elite traveling through time to find and reap our future sown. We would seek the harvest of our race's last desperate attempt to survive, the starseeds, the manifest urge of the people to live, even as our homeworld was destroyed. For the Eldred proved most capable creations. They allied the other races against us, overthrew us, and destroyed our planet, our homeworld. They would go on to rule, in turn, for a million years, until they too grew corrupt and cruel, and blind to their own limitations, as the people had. As the Eldred descended and the people fell, the starseeds carried our urge to live out into the universe and on into the future. More than a million were launched. The starseeds sped through the night, fiery balls of water, proteins, amino acids, and potential. Gravity formed new worlds orbiting infant stars, pulled together matter and surrounding energy, and protoplanets coalesced. Starseeds pounded protoworlds, creating pools of potential life, soupy steaming cauldrons of essential amino acids and basic compounds. Strands sent forth by the urge started a million worlds down the course towards life, the way of evolution, the path to self-realization, intelligence, and motivation. In the right places, under the right circumstances, it began again. Sentience, the drive to survive, to live, to become, to explore, to span space, to live among the stars. And all the while, the starseeds continued their sowing. So it continued through a million years. Worlds rise and fall, each isolate alone, yet the urge incarnates each time, when it can. For the Eldred also seek the starseeds, to destroy them before they can evolve. The Eldred discovered the longevity plan, when we, the best of us, told them of it. Still, some new races got through. Each time the urge advanced, seeds were sown, races rose, took flight, spanned space, and expanded into the stars. Eventually, Homo sapiens arrive, a human incarnation of the urge, on planet Earth, on the fringe of the star seeds' dispersal. Earth was on the fringe, but this arm of the galaxy was an active place and a target for starseeds. There were many races out there ahead of humankind, principalities and powers vying amongst themselves for position. Long before humans ever thought coherent thoughts, for many millennia humankind believed it was alone. Yet you were not alone. Those who came before were not above interference. At least two races knew of Earth and visited and interfered over time. The Flays and the Domo attempted stealth, but their meddling created legends and mythologies, from UFO greys back to shape-shifting vampires. And we, the best of us, we arrived accidentally well before them, and yet discovered we'd found our way just the same. Traveling through time and space with the bioelectrical matrices of the elite of the people, we detached from the mob upon perceiving a planet with potential life receptacles and came down to your Earth, deciding to teach and live among you, our chosen human names occasionally echoing down through your myths and histories. Which brings us up to your time. Most of us were long gone, or sleeping the sleep of long stasis, by the time humankind seemed to leap for space, then settle back down, through your 1960s and 70s. From my own stony sleep, I saw the shortages force humankind back into space, and watched humankind return to the moon for raw materials, build 3 commercial space stations in orbit, and 6 commercial outposts on the moon, to pump out raw materials. The US, Japanese, and EU together established a lunar base and colony, central hub for a growing number of lunar habitations and industrial operations. Moon mined mineral wealth was also fused and shaped into more orbital platforms, workstations, and colonies, where more raw materials were processed, then sent down to Earth. The commercialization of space took off. The commercialization of space took off. The moon shipped raw materials to orbital assembly stations, which created goods for an ever-growing Earth populace, dropping them down the gravity well to hungry hordes. The ships carried goods down. Supplies came back up. Supply runs paid for by the goods sold. The technology wasn't yet truly ready to support large-scale populations on the moon. Orbital colonies weren't perfected yet either. They tended to be dangerous, prone to air leaks, oxygen shortages, and waste recycling nightmares. But these problems didn't slow the race to space. The commercial potential of space was tapped, and corporations wanted more. Government and commercial partnerships began exploring ways to push further out, to get to Mars and the mineral wealth of the asteroids. Soon, humankind didn't have any choice but to expand into space. Overpopulation led to demand outstripping supply. Population pressures taxed the delivery system. Goods stopped reaching consumers, and there were riots and rationing. Wealthy individuals built orbital retreats to get away from the population on Earth. Overpopulation became a marketing tool for selling paranoid rich people orbital getaways in space, as at first only the very wealthy could afford to build, staff, and maintain these luxury stations. Most rotated to give a semblance of gravity, using interconnected systems requiring small, versatile crews to run and maintain. The necessities of life had to be provided for the crew and inhabitants. All those people had to eat, breathe, and live on the station, or be shipped back and forth to a nearby commercial platform or station. It was an expensive proposition, especially in the early days, but over time, costs came down, and orbital platforms became attainable for second echelon wealth. As population pressure increased, Earth's governments started looking into orbital or lunar colonies as possible population relief valves. Their initial lunar colonizing effort, however, was a thinly disguised recruitment campaign for workers for the companies mining the surface of the moon. The lunar population of company workers were ostensibly under UN jurisdiction, but it was really the megacorporations who called the shots, until IMC mercilessly and publicly gunned down a rogue worker, inviting public outcry. No individual Earth government alone was powerful enough to sanction IMC, so they worked together through the UN, strengthening the muscle of the world body to give their sanctions some bite, committing more funds and troops. The Secretary General used this opportunity to extend the UN's powers, securing independent control of the moon under joint UN security forces, placing all orbital facilities under enforceable UN jurisdiction. The Earth's governments then stepped up their efforts towards Mars and the asteroids, pressured by the IMC and other megacorps to find new sources of raw materials. The drive for Mars gave the governments reason to build their own new facilities on the moon, a lunar staging area, a base for the mission that grew to serve as the new central port for the moon. The 2030s. Reagan Station was officially dedicated on the moon in 2030 by the cooperating governments of Earth, signaling a fresh start. Primarily a research station for the Mars mission, it paid for itself through commercial enterprise. The US, the EU, and Russian governments partnered with an entertainment group in a first-of-its-kind pairing of utility and frivolity. The entertainment group paid a fee and taxes to the governments. In exchange, they got space on the station and supply space on shuttles up from Earth, and the chance to make a profit from all the workers on the moon. An entire entertainment complex was built into the station, with movie theaters, restaurants, bordellos, churches, temples, and other diversions. For the first time, aside from onboard the luxury stations of the very wealthy, more than just the bare essential needs of the population in space were considered. It was an original approach that drew both praise and scorn. Some religious groups expressed outrage over the contents of some of the entertainment. Some politicians argued it was a waste of precious air and space. Ultimately, economic realities pushed the partnership ahead, and the moon entered a new phase of colonization with more focus on both science and entertainment. The entertainment group then acquired space in orbit, and the first station solely devoted to worker entertainment opened soon after in an abandoned luxury station. This new opportunity didn't go unnoticed. The group's major competitor sued, citing restraint of trade, saying they were unfairly shut out of this new opportunity, and the governments were forced to find space for them on the moon and in orbit. These were distractions for the governments, focused on launching a Mars mission from Reagan Station before the end of the year. The first manned Mars mission left Reagan Station in 2030, on the last day of 2030, but still in 2030. The trip to Mars took a year and a half. There was gravity on a portion of the ship, so the crew could exercise and stay fit. Their mission was to establish a working base on Mars and live there for a year and a half, setting up hydroponic gardens, installing life systems, and general housekeeping so the base could be sustained. Another mission would follow after a year and a half. At that time, they'd go back to Earth. The governments involved wanted to quickly establish a constantly manned base on Mars. The next mission left on schedule in 2032, as news of the first ship's arrival on Mars reached Earth and the Moon. The first mission successfully deployed on the surface of Mars as the new ship powered up for its own long journey. By the time the new ship arrived at the end of 2033, there were casualties. A husband and wife, xenoarchaeologists, disappeared while on a long-distance reconnoiter. Other news was not immediately released to the general public. The two xenoarchaeologists had uncovered alien artifacts, evidence of another civilization, not necessarily Martian in origin. The ruins were just the smallest remains of an alien staging area on Mars, a base possibly used when interfering with Earth. This wasn't revealed to the public until 2039. The U.S. kept the information under wraps. It was alleged, but never proven, that the U.S. had discovered similar artifacts on the moon years earlier. The bodies of husband and wife were never recovered. The nature of their disappearance was not fully explained when the rest of the expedition returned in 2035, just chalked up to the inhospitability of the Red Planet. But in official circles, it was suggested that they had been abducted, perhaps by the very aliens whose artifacts they had been rummaging around in, although the ruins had seemed rather old and useless. No other alien ruins or artifacts were discovered by the successive Mars missions of 2033 or 2035. The Mars base tried to become self-sustaining, but was left unmanned at the end of 2035. A number of factors made it hard to continue. The distance to home became hard to deal with after a year and a half. Many Mars colonists spent their return trips under some kind of sedation. It wasn't the distance that was the problem, the governments figured, but rather the inability to cross that distance quickly. The UN's power eroded as the megacorps extended their new Earth-based freedoms to Earth orbit and the moon. Class increasingly divided the human population. Wealthy megacorporate elite, mid-level consumers, and service workers. The UN was dealt a severe blow when Muslim nations Egypt and Syria withdrew from the space programs and then from the world body in 2035, in protest of what they called its Judeo-Christian bias. They condemned the West as infidels and fought against this perceived bias. Their claim of Judeo-Christian bias was reinforced when the alien artifact information came out in 2039. In 2036, the UTZ, United Trade Zone, was established, uniting the U.S., Canada, Mexico, South and Central America, and the EU and Russia in a free trade zone, also encompassing those countries' holdings on the moon, in orbit, and even Mars. The UTZ Governing Council was made up of CEOs and politicians from each of the countries, wolves watching the henhouse. The megacorporations had free run, although the U.S. and other Earth governments tried to hold on to control of the Moon and the Mars projects. The government's decided to try to mount a return mission to the base on Mars to reinvigorate Mars and their moon station. Back on Earth, Asia became a source of conflict. The Chinese Revolution of 2037 was a long time coming, and as much about access to goods and services as it was about casting off a century of communist rule. The Chinese people wanted all the stuff they saw the workers of the non-communist world consuming. Technology outstripped the communist government's ability to censor the people's information, and that information made the people want to buy, buy, buy. When the new democratic Chinese government was installed, it was barely a government at all. A large single-body parliament with a prime minister and a president elected by the people, but they had no true power. The megacorporations had moved in immediately after the new government joined the UTZ. English became a predominant language in the new China and the world in general, to the alarm of many cultural purists. Cultures blended furiously as the UTZ knocked down old barriers in the name of trade. Japanese cultural purists then sounded the alarm, fearing Asia would be westernized. The proud Japanese tradition bred extremists unwilling to compromise, to join in the westernization of the culture. But the Chinese, cowed for a century by the communists, bowed readily to their new commercial masters. The Japanese had formed their own trade zone, the Pacific Trade Cooperative, or PTC, in 2035, but it had floundered. There were only a couple of Japanese stations in orbit, and they had no holdings on the moon. At this time, Japan was also torn by ultra-nationalist fervor. The PTC struggled in the face of Japan's own isolationism. It eventually allied itself with the UTZ as an agent of the UTZ by 2039. The PTC became a puppet organization, but still retained enough control to remain external to the main group. The UN was dealt another blow in 2037 when the African National Council withdrew. Many countries grumbled about the UN's inability to get anything done. Tensions in the always volatile Middle East flared up again as Muslim hardliners gained political control along with religious power. More and more subjugated workers turned away from the megacorps and towards Islam and Allah. 2039 saw a new joint mission to Mars, an attempt to try again. Organized by the U.S., the UN had a member on board, and the UTZ as well. IMC was a major sponsor and had 10 of their scientists on the crew. Dubbed Operation Trailblazer, the mission was an ambitious attempt to indeed blaze a trail for future travelers. IMC had developed new technology, promising ultrasonic travel using a series of magnetic loops. The reaction of magnetic forces propelled magnetized bullet-like ships through these magnetic loops onward, faster and faster, loop by loop. Operation Trailblazer was a construction project, setting up these loops in space as it cruised on toward Mars. The idea behind the loops: a ship could leave the moon, propel itself through the first loop, and the magnetic force would amplify the speed of the ship. The ship then reached the second loop and came out even faster, then hit the third, the fourth, and so on, until at midpoint the ship reversed polarity and began to slow down as it went through each successive loop. The loops were massive, like giant round suspension bridges to nowhere floating in space. They were assembled just off the moon by IMC. Trailblazer's job was to push them out to where they belonged and turn them on. Trailblazer made Mars in early 2040, followed in a month by the first ship down the magnetic loop highway, a supply ship. There were problems. Acceleration was hard to cushion against and compensate for, and the human body didn't take kindly to too many G-forces. The force of the speed their ship attained killed the first bullet ship's crew. IMC made adjustments: softer acceleration, better shock absorption. Soon bullet ships were buzzing up and down the Magloop Highway, as it came to be called, carrying people and supplies back and forth to Mars. IMC and other megacorporations began mining Mars for raw materials, shipping people in on bullet ships, sending raw materials back. The Magloop Highway allowed for the rapid colonization of Mars as megacorporations raced to exploit its resources and designated supply areas ceded to them by the governments involved in earlier exploration. The Japanese, through their agency involvement in the UTZ-PTC Pact, began joining in the exploration of Mars in a major way. As humans began trying to tame the planet of the God of War, wars for God broke out on their home planet. Israel invoked an old clause from the peace accords that allowed them to again take back sole control of Jerusalem if duly threatened. They did this and asked for help not from the UN, but from the UTZ, to help keep out those they expelled and maintain the security of Israel and Jerusalem. Extremist Muslim governments allied with Iran now ruled Egypt and Syria. The only reason they didn't yet rule the Palestinian state was they could not. It was not allowed under the accords. But after their expulsion from Jerusalem, extremists overpowered more moderate Palestinian leaders. The 30s ended with the earth a pressure cooker waiting to blow. The 2040s. Sponsor countries from the UTZ had troops under UTZ control occupying Jerusalem, guarding it against the expelled as the 2040s began. Jerusalem was a city under siege. The Arab Muslim countries united against Israel as the United Islamic Nations, the UIN. They brought increasing economic pressure and the threat of war against the State of Israel. The siege lasted a year, until 2041, when an old Russian H-bomb destroyed Jerusalem. The devastation was complete. All of it. The Dome of the Rock, the Wailing Wall, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They were all leveled, fused into glass. Over 500,000 people were killed. Many sons and daughters of the UTZ were killed in its destruction, guarding the city under siege. The UIN took no credit and no pride in the destruction of Jerusalem, for it was one of their holy places as well. The UTZ and Israel blame the new UIN for its implicit involvement. The UTZ airlifted Israelis out of the fallout zone to the EU and the US, and to a refurbished old orbital station. Others still were resettled on the moon. The lunar colony grew to four times its original size in just 2 years. The UTZ came out firmly against the UIN and threatened retribution for Jerusalem. The UIN pointed out the bomb was an old-fashioned Russian hydrogen bomb, the kind that had been disappearing from Russia since the Soviet Union dissolved. Anyone could get their hands on them on the open black market. The UIN blamed a fringe group for the destruction, but the UTZ struck back at the heart of the UIN, using nuclear weapons to destroy Damascus and Tehran. The loss of civilian life was not considered. Blood called out for blood, as the UTZ's personal losses blinded the empathy of the people, and nobody got away scot-free. The three major detonations released a great deal of radioactive material into the atmosphere and altered the Earth's climate. Major storms raged across the planet, hurricanes, monsoons, and blizzards. There were several earthquakes of 7 on the Richter scale and higher. Many wealthy types made for the high frontier once again, building new orbital getaways and refurbishing older ones. 2042 began with the West, the UTZ, in control of most of the orbital areas. UIN sources controlled 3 or 4 of the old private stations, renamed the Prophet's Fortresses. In the countries of the UTZ, Christianity and Judaism flourished in opposition to the Muslim resurgence. The focus of Jewish life moved to the moon, when several leading rabbis joined the lunar community and built their new temple in heaven in New Jerusalem on the moon. The Pope enjoyed an upswing in popularity, consulted by member countries' leaders, the U.S. President and British Prime Minister, the Irish PM, and Canada's top official, the PM in absentia, GM MacDonald. The Pope's influence was hard to measure, but certainly the fact that these leaders acknowledged him as their spiritual leader spoke to his power. With the new state of war, people turned to Catholicism and the older Christian religions for comfort and hope. The UTZ encouraged the religious fervor of the Christians to solidify support for their anti-UIN efforts. 2042 also saw the rise of a new Ayatollah in Turkey, Ayatollah Aziz called Jihad, declaring holy war on those who mocked the Prophet. He declared that Islam was the only way mankind's love affair with Allah, the Creator, could be expressed. He also called for an Arabian Renaissance of mathematics and science and the technical arts in service to Allah, with the stated goal of Islam once again becoming the instrument by which mankind's intellect was expressed, a pure expression of love for Allah. An Islamic technical revolution began. The jihad began as a terror campaign. Isolated targets within UTZ countries were hit by a number of different weapons: bombs, nerve gas, biotoxins, and water supply poisoning. The PTC attempted to remain somewhat separate from the rest of the decidedly Judeo-Christian UTZ and saw increased investment as megacorps shifted wealth out of the threatened countries into the PTC's relatively safe harbor. Australia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Indonesia, China, most of the Pacific Rim were members of the PTC. Japan grew increasingly isolationist, however, until 2045, when a militant nationalist Japanese government tried to secede from the UTZ-PTC unsuccessfully. The secession was avoided, and Japan was soothed by a couple of concessions, the biggest of which was control over a major part of UTZ's Mars operation. They got their own supply area and the surrounding terrain. One of the already profitable areas was turned over to Japan to run as the PTC representative country. Many of the most militant Japanese were then forced by the UTZ to volunteer to serve on Mars. The UTZ reasoned that away from their homeland, their power would be diminished. It did not work that way. Up through 2050 of the Archmage's History of the Future on Glow in the Dark Radio. A half-hour chunk of fictional future history. Now, patrons got to hear this originally, and they also got a paperback. I did a small, thin paperback version and gave them a copy of the Archmage's History of the Future as an ebook. So there are benefits to becoming a patron. That's stuff that's so far not available to other people. Just to my good patrons. Patreon.com/glowinthedarkradio is the place to go for that. Patrons this week are getting Chapter 4 of the new Vatican Assassin 15th Anniversary Edition. Ahead of everybody else, we will begin Chapter 1 of that new special edition on this podcast on our next episode next week. All right, now some Q&A. I promised to do some Q&A, and I did get some Qs. My first question came in from Ken from Honolulu. And Ken wanted to know, he said, I was wondering how you envisioned the wand. He's like, you keep talking about the wand. Everybody uses the wand. Alibi uses the wand. And basically, when I first was writing this story, I think it's Alibi uses the wand more so than BC. I don't think I had it in Vatican Assassin. But I was writing Alibi Jones as the iPhone was getting invented. So there weren't iPhones yet. Smartphones, sure, like Blackberries and flip phones and things. So I kind of envisioned this, the wand, as a sort of long phone with like a screen and controls on one side, but not exactly like an iPhone, but more like long and thin. I kind of pictured it being sort of flat with two like wide sides and two very thin sides. But it would be thicker than a phone because it has a power source that lets it connect with this ancient alien technology. Basically, the wands are tapping into a communication network that was left over from the ancient enemy and the Eldred, which is what allows for the instantaneous communication faster than light. Otherwise, you couldn't have that. We haven't even perfected the ability to do that yet to add to this network. If you remember in Alibi Jones and the Hornet's Nest, Anita, when she's sent off on her mission by Constantine, it's a mission to try to set up some of these, like, transfer points, nodes, in this network. The project's been working on reverse engineering and trying to create these ourselves, but so far, we're connecting into an alien network. So inside of the wand, there's an incredible power source, as well as, I don't know if I'd call it an antenna, but the means to connect into this kind of subspace communication network created by the ancient enemy and maintained by the Eldred. So that's a little bit about how I envision the wand. It's kind of tech that we're using without quite understanding it completely. We know how it works enough to make it work. I also got a couple questions from Mark. Not sure where Mark is. My guess might be UK. But I know he's not in the US based on his last question, or at least I don't think he is. But question one from Mark was, if the knowledge base comes from the ancient enemy, its refusal to communicate with Alibi seems out of character based on our previous experiences of them. Well, its refusal to communicate is really more a manifestation of the safeguards that are in place. The ancient enemy don't want to turn over their knowledge without being sure it's going to a person who should be getting it. Now, Alibi and humans are a lot like the ancient enemy, but we're not identical. So there's a resistance there. The knowledge base would like to cooperate with Alibi more, but it's still not sure. And so the things that you're getting the impression are its refusal to communicate with Alibi, it's really more, those are our security safeguards that are in place. That's how they manifest, is it seems like it doesn't want to talk or, you know, isn't willing to help Alibi at certain points. That's because those are our safeguards that are built into this thing, this knowledge base. The ancient enemy, while they are pretty ruthless, they're also rather, well, precious. They want to safeguard their knowledge. This is the sum total of everything they have stored in this starseed. And they had hoped to uncover it themselves, so it wasn't necessarily meant for other races to even be using. So it's the fact that we resemble them that's allowing Alibi to have the success he's had in the first place. Well, that and the overlay that the Archmage gave him, the gift under the mountain. That also has helped him to communicate and be accepted by the knowledge base. Okay, and Mark's second question, Q2, was, has Wentworth really dropped off the political map completely? Seems out of character for him. Well, people think Wentworth is dead. So, yeah. I'm not saying he is. There's also a suspicion that he's had himself artificially extended. Like, he may have his consciousness, you know, somehow contained in a neural network, an artificial neural network of some kind. Now, it's never been said out loud in the books, but at some point in time, there was something that went wrong with AI, because it's not allowed. No Butlerian jihad in this case. Although, you know, I am a Frank Herbert fan. Dune is my favorite book. I will admit that. It's an influence. But no, there's just there was an incident a while back where something went wrong and AI just isn't used any longer. So neural networks aren't something that are common anymore. Limited neural networks, sure, but not massive ones that could contain a human consciousness. But still, Wentworth being the most wealthy and most powerful human for a few years, most everyone figures he must have done something to keep himself alive past the point of regular existence. But it could be that people are just speculating. At this point in time, though, the word is that Wentworth has died. But nobody really thinks he's dead. What's kind of fun is that that's a question that in some ways is addressed in the beginning of the next Alibi Jones book, which I've been writing, which is the sequel to The Starseeds of Earth. So that's a good question to ask. We do get a little bit of an insight into who the power players are now in the colonies and the Solar Alliance in the new Alibi Jones book. So that'll help explain some of this stuff with Wentworth, I think. Mark also asked, any plans for signed copies of the 15th anniversary edition, especially outside of the U.S., which is why I figured he was from outside the U.S. So far, I don't have a print proof back yet, so I don't have books in hand. If there is a demand for signed copies, I'm going to have to do it. I'll have to figure out a way. But Mark, you're the first to ask for one, so not the last. I've already had another request, so thank you. Thank you. It's an awesome question to be asked. And as Mark said, this was another nice thing he said. He says he's looking forward to the next book. As, quote, you left us with more unanswered questions than when the book started. Yes, I guess I probably did. And it's funny, John, the Bacon Man on Twitter, has been bugging me for a Q&A for a little bit. Well, not bugging me, just asking me if I was going to do it. But I hadn't seen any questions from him, so I actually went to him before recording and said, okay, so what are your cues for the Q&A? So he wanted to know, how does currency work? Is it Solar Alliance credits? Well, in the Solar Alliance, certainly. But it also varies station to station, colony to colony, ship to ship. I would say it's akin to the European Union and the Euro, the Solar Alliance credit. And the credit's value, a lot of it is based on resources, tangible assets, and raw materials. You don't need currency for everything either. Some things are assumed to be collective. When they started to go out into space and started to colonize, you can't put a price on food, water, clothing. These things can't be stratified and preserve any kind of harmony. And because ships and stations and even the early colonies are on a small scale, there's more of an ability to address this. So currency comes into play more for luxury items, additional things. But basic needs are kind of covered. It's not exactly Star Trek, but it's better than United States 21st century capitalism, let's say, as far as taking care of more people. More equally. And John also asked, are things printed or actually manufactured? Are we at that point yet in tech? There is a great deal of printing. Actually, one of his other questions after that was, always wondered about replicated foods and liquids on ship or on stations like the Hornet's Nest. And the food and the replicators, they don't call them replicators. They are printers, basically. They're like food printers. And a lot of it is reclamation. A lot of it is reclaiming body fluids and solids. But we use stuff up. So it also requires raw materials that are added in to the printers to give it both bulk, substance, and nutrition. So there are basically giant print cartridges full of nutritious protein, kind of, that also get injected into the reclamation or the reclaimed bodily fluids and solids that it's kind of gross to talk about, but you know, you're in space, you got to fix this. You got to be able to reuse stuff. So a lot of what we do is printing, but you know, what they found is that there are some things you need to manufacture as well. You can print the raw materials, or you can print using raw materials, but there is still some assembly and manufacture required. There still needs to be basic raw material handling and processing in order to create a situation where you can print this kind of stuff. But again, not everything can be printed. And there is some need for some assembly. Hey, there is some assembly required. So that's where we are as far as tech goes. And I don't want to go into too much detail because it's actually something that's also being covered in the next Alibi Jones book, the sequel that I'm working on. Because at the end of the Starseeds of Earth, the Hornet's Nest has been flung somewhere and they don't know where they are. Being lost like that, they don't have access to their usual supplies. So these kind of things are going to be coming into play in the new book. So it was neat to see these questions being asked, because these are definitely questions being raised. All right, I hope that answers those questions, at least to some degree. A little bit of Q&A on this week's podcast. Once again, thank you for listening. And be sure you're back here next week for the first chapter of the new edition of Vatican Assassin. Vatican Assassin, the 15th anniversary edition, audiobook adaptation, begins right here on the podcast on Glow in the Dark Radio next week. If you need any details on anything, just head to glowinthedarkradio.com or mikeluoma.com. I'm your host, your writer and reader, Mike Luoma. Thank you again for listening to Glow in the Dark Radio. Glow in the Dark Radio. This podcast presentation is copyright 2020 by Michael F. Luoma and is protected under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. CC by NCND 4.0. Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can find his work at Accompetech.com and filmmusic.io. Mike's books are available in ebook, paperback, and audiobook wherever you find books online. Get links and more details at glowinthedarkradio.com and mikeluoma.com. This has been a presentation of Glow in the Dark Radio.